Senate Higher Ed Committee will come to order. And today we are lucky to have with us representatives of MNSCU, and the Chancellor is with us, Chancellor McCormick, and I believe you will be starting and leading us through the process you have kind of figured out for your presentation. So, great. Chancellor McCormick, welcome very much. And I know you have some individuals with you that you'd like to take just a minute to introduce to.
Thank you, Chair Fischbach and committee members, and delighted to greet a number of you again today. And for the record, my name is Jim McCormick, and I have the great privilege of serving as Chancellor of the Minnesota State College and University System. And with me today is Scott Thiss, who is the Chair of the Board of Trustees, and Richard Davenport, the President of Minnesota State University Mankato, and Kevin Kopischke, the President of Alexandria Technical and Community College. Welcome. And we have, Chair Fischbach, we have several trustees and presidents in the audience today, and I'd like to start with the trustees. We have Trustee Cheryl Dixon and Trustee Christopher Frederick, and Trustee Louise Sundin, and Trustee James Van Houten, and several presidents, Joe Opatz, Normandale Community College, and Donovan Swichtenberg from St. Paul College, and any other presidents arrived since the time. We may have several others here.
Well, and welcome to all of you, and particularly former House Member Opatz, who I was had a pleasure to serve with for a short time.
We've been asked today by the chair to present an overview of the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and particularly the vital role that it plays as one of the critical economic engines for this great state. Chair Thiss will begin by giving you some key facts about the system.
Chair Thiss, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thank you, Chancellor. I'm pleased to be here today on behalf of the Board of Trustees of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. We know that higher education today faces some tough issues. A key question that you face as legislators will be, how will Minnesota best prepare for a return to economic prosperity? Minnesota State Colleges and University System plays an important role in answering that question. Our campuses are located throughout the state. Each year, we produce nearly 35,000 graduates. 80% of them stay in Minnesota to work or continue their education. They provide a real return on the state's investment. We also provide customized training and other job-related education to almost 122,000 students. The system has 7 state universities that offer bachelor's and advanced degrees, 5 technical colleges with programs leading to employment, 5 community colleges that offer arts and science programs for transfer to 4-year institutions and occupational programs, and 15 combined community and technical colleges with transfer programs and technical programs that prepare students for direct entry into careers. We have 54 campuses, 47 communities, which amounts to about 1/3 of the state's real estate. Chancellor McCormick will now tell you more about our students.
Thank you, Chair Thiss.
Chancellor McCormick.
Chair Fischbach. We are the single largest provider of higher education in Minnesota, educating 63% of all Minnesota undergraduate students. Each year, we educate more than 433,000 students in credit and non-credit courses. Our colleges and universities offer more than 3,900 different programs. They range from short-term programs that can be completed in 2 years or less to bachelor's and advanced degree programs. Many of our students do not fit the profile of a traditional college student who is enrolled full-time and lives on campus. The average age of our students is nearly 26. Women make up 55% of our student body. Many of our students attend classes part-time because they must work to pay tuition and, in many cases, to support their families. Though we have many academically talented students, We also serve nearly all of the post-secondary students who are least prepared for college. The mission of our two-year colleges is open access. That means anyone with a high school diploma or a GED can enroll in our colleges. Many of the least prepared students are young people who are a year or two out of high school, or working adults who may have forgotten their high school algebra or never took it in the first place. In other words, we serve the hardest to serve students who often have to overcome significant barriers to complete their programs. We always worry about the ability of our students to pay for their education. That is why the Board of Trustees has done its best to keep the tuition in check. From 2006 to 2011, tuition and fees have gone up an average of 4.5% each year. We have had record enrollments for each of the last 5 years. This slide shows the growth in full-time equivalent enrollment. Since 2006, we've had an 18% increase. More young people are graduating from high school and realizing the need for some post-secondary education. More adults are upgrading their skills, knowledge, because they've been laid off or want to change careers. In either case, they want good jobs and they want to be able to earn a living. Just as Minnesota's population is changing, the demographic profile of our students is shifting. Students from groups traditionally underrepresented in higher education, that is, students of color, first-generation college students, and low-income students, now make up 71% of our student body. During the last 5 years, we've had 31% increase in the number of underrepresented students, bringing the current total to more than 130,000. Now, these students are the state's current future workforce. Students of color now make up 18% of the student body, up from 14% 5 years ago. The demand for online learning is increasing. We've had more than 400 programs and 10,000 course sections online. Since 2005, we've quadrupled the online enrollment. At the current rate of growth, the system is on track to reach its 2015 goal of having 25% of the system's full-time equivalent enrollment in online and blended online courses. We expect to reach 18% and be over 100,000 online students this year. Now, our graduates, and this is the real test for the future of Minnesota, contribute to the vitality of communities across the state in many ways. Every year, the college and university and the system educate, just as a few examples. 83% of the state's new nursing graduates, 49% of the state's new teaching graduates, 85% of the state's new law enforcement officers, 38% of the new business graduates, and we train 9,000 firefighters and first responders. Clearly, we educate Minnesota and we make it work. Now, over the years, we have consolidated and merged campuses. As a result, we went from 45 presidents to 32 presidents. We're continuing to work on this. Now I'm going to turn it over to President Kopischke and President Davenport to tell you about our system's colleges and universities and how they build Minnesota's economy. President Kopischke.
Thank you, Chancellor, Chair Fischbach, members. We'd like to give you a very brief introduction.
I'm sorry, if you could just identify yourself for the record.
Yes,
be great.
My name is Kevin Kopischke, President at Alexandria Technical and Community College.
Thank you.
We'd like to give you a very brief introduction to our colleges and universities. Each contributes to the strategic goal to increase access, opportunity, and success in their communities. And each plays a critical role in building that local and regional economy that in turn contributes to Minnesota's economic health and vitality and a great state to live in and do business in. In a quick introduction to each college and university, we'll identify the president. Last year's unduplicated headcount in credit-based courses and one of only many distinguishing features of that college or university. Let me begin with the colleges, starting with the college I serve, Alexandria Technical and Community College. You can follow along in the Go Places magazine if you'd like to kind of keep track of where we're going, and we're going to move quickly, beginning on page 16. It's the Go Places magazine, page 16.
Members, that should be in your packet.
It's in the right. It's on the right-hand packet of your right inside of your packet. At Alexandria Technical and Community College, we recently signed an agreement with Rockwell Automation, the world's largest industrial automation company, to expand worker training in central Minnesota and throughout the United States. And At ATCC, we serve approximately 3,700 students. At Anoka-Ramsey Community College, with campuses in Cambridge and Coon Rapids, interim president is Jessica Stump. ARCC serves over 11,000 students, and their work in the biomedical technical field has earned them a number of federal grants for curriculum development and programming to support their partnerships with industry. At Anoka Technical College in Anoka, where Sherry Olson is the interim president, serving 3,400 students, Minnesota Workforce Centers refer many clients to Anoka Tech's Certified Medical Assistant Program for training to work with electronic medical record systems, a high-demand skill in that area for right now. At Central Lakes College, with campuses in Staples and Brainerd, serving over 5,500 students, Larry Lundblad is the president. And Central Lakes is known as a nationwide leader in technology. It was rated one of the nation's top 8 digital colleges, according to the Center for Digital Education. At Century College in White Bear Lake, President Larry Letecki serving over 13,000 students. Century is one of our largest and fastest-growing colleges. A unique offering at Century is its Fab Lab, where students use fabrication tools and software to build just about anything. At Dakota County Technical College in Rosemount, President Ron Thomas serving about 5,300 students. DCTC is a nationwide leader in the field of nanotechnology. In fact, the National Science Foundation awarded Dakota Tech a $3 million grant to develop the Midwest Regional Center for Nanotechnology Education. At Fond du Lac Tribal and Community College in Cloquet, led by Larry Anderson, approximately 2,700 students are served. Fond du Lac is the only tribal and community college in the system. It provides higher education opportunities for its communities, focusing on the language, culture, and the history of the Anishinaabe. At Hennepin Technical College, with campuses in Brooklyn Park and Eden Prairie, serving nearly 8,600 students, President Celia Cervantes, Hennepin Tech works with more than 300 industry advisory members to ensure the curriculum needs meet industry standards. Inver Hills Community College in Inver Grove Heights, Tim Wines, president, serving 8,500 students. Inver Hills serves as a regional training center for Cisco Academy instructor courses that teach students how to design, build, troubleshoot, and secure computer networks. At Lake Superior College in Duluth, led by President Pat John, serving 8,500 students, Lake Superior's Emergency Response Training Center provides world-class training for emergency response professionals, including firefighters and EMTs. Phil Davis leads Minneapolis Community and Technical College, serving nearly 13,500 students. And MCTC offers a number of unique programs, including air traffic control, apparel technologies, biotechnology, computer forensics, homeland security, to just name a few. At Minnesota State College, Southeast Technical and Red Wing in Winona, serving over 3,000 students, Jim Johnson is the president. Students are trained as technicians in the fast-growing emerging field of geothermal technology at Southeast Tech. Minnesota State Community and Technical Colleges, a college with campuses in Detroit Lakes, Fergus Falls, Moorhead, and Wadena, President Ann Valentine, serving almost 9,000 students. We're excited to announce that Fergus Falls is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year and recently introduced a one-year diploma program in equine science. Minnesota West Community and Technical College, with campuses in Canby, Granite Falls, Jackson, Pipestone, and Worthington, serves nearly 4,500 students, President Richard Shrub. And Minnesota West is the first campus in the system to erect an on-campus wind tower used for both learning and power generation. Normandale Community College in Bloomington, President Joe Opatz, serves over 14,000 students. And Normandale is one of only 4 community colleges across the nation that is now accredited in 3 fine arts areas: theater, music, and art. At North Hennepin Community College in Brooklyn Park, serving nearly 10,000 students, John O'Brien is the president. And veterans attending North Hennepin can find assistance for navigating the challenging array of federal, state, and local veterans programs on-site at their Veterans Resource Center. Veterans Resource Centers are available at most of our colleges and university campuses. The Northeast Higher Education District, with campuses in Hibbing, Grand Rapids, Ely, Eveleth, Virginia, and International Falls, serves over 7,000 students, the President Sue Collins. This consortium of 5 colleges supports the area's economic vitality, particularly with specialty programs in natural resources, industrial mechanical technology, green and sustainable construction technology, wildlife and law enforcement and forestry. At Northland Community College, Community and Technical College, led by Ann Tempty, with campuses in East Grand Forks and Thief River Falls, serving 5,600 students, Northland will be offering an unmanned aircraft systems maintenance program to meet the growing need for unmanned aerial vehicle mechanics in both military and civilian sectors. Northwest Technical College in Bemidji, President Richard Hansen, serves 2,400 students. Northwest Tech and 13 area high schools have formed a consortium to strengthen career and technical education beginning in the ninth grade and leading to an industry-recognized certificate in associate or bachelor's degree. Pine Technical College, led by Robert Musgrove, serves 1,235 students in Pine City. The Johnson Center at Pine Tech offers virtual reality simulator training in their welding and spray painting programs. Quality assurance is an important part of their curriculum. At Ridgewater College, with Hutchinson and Wilmer campuses, led by President Doug Allen, serving nearly 5,800 students, Ridgewater recently rolled out a high-tech mobile medical training facility to serve medical clinics and hospitals across the state of Minnesota. At Riverland Community College, with campuses in Albert Lea, Austin, and Owatonna, serving nearly 5,000 students, President Terry Leese, the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation named Riverland Community College as the 2010 Partner of the Year for capitalizing on the assets of new immigrants and minority populations to help increase community vitality in southern Minnesota. Don Cipolla leads Rochester Community and Technical College, serving nearly 7,900 students, and the Center for Business and Workforce Education at RCTC designs training programs for IBM and the Mayo Clinic, among other businesses, agribusinesses, and healthcare organizations. St. Cloud Technical and Community College is led by Joyce Hellens, serving nearly 5,200 students. Cardiovascular technology is a new field of study at St. Cloud Tech. Students prepare to assist cardiologists with diagnostic procedures and interventions, such as angioplasty and stent placement. St. Paul College, led by President Donovan Schwichtenberg, serves over 8,700 students, and St. Paul College was ranked as the top community college in the country by Washington Monthly Magazine, which referred to the college's blend of technical education and liberal arts as Shakespeare with power tools. And at South Central College, with campuses in North Mankato and Faribault, led by President Keith Stover, serving nearly 5,600 students, South Central is known for high-tech manufacturing programs, including computer-integrated machining. And now I'll introduce President Richard Davenport to introduce you to our state universities.
Before we go there, I believe Senator Saxog has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. President Kubitschke, you mentioned St. Paul College and it being by one publication ranked very high in the nation. So, sell me on the fact that our two-year colleges are some of the best in the nation for what they do.
Chair Fischbach, Senator Saxog, I started teaching in this system 35 years ago at Alexandria. As we've moved through those 35 years, I've been heavily involved with initiatives in the state of Minnesota and throughout the country. I sincerely believe that as we look at how we've built community partnerships among the economic centers in small and rural and large communities in the state of Minnesota, our two-year colleges have simply emerged as some of the best in this country. And the research by the Washington Monthly Magazine points out the types of things based on their research that focused on retention and graduation and student input. Customer service types of things, training students to do the types of jobs in the economic sectors that we believe are going to continue to drive the health of the state of Minnesota. We are very, very good at doing just that on the range throughout the state of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Thank you. President Davenport.
Madam Chair Fischbach, I'm Richard Davenport, president of Minnesota State University in Mankato. And now I'd like to introduce our seven universities, so you can follow the same tour by turning to page 34 of Go Places. As you heard earlier, we have seven distinct and outstanding regional universities, and these are all comprehensive in nature, meaning that in order to fulfill accreditation requirements, They all must offer a variety of required baccalaureate and graduate programs in the arts and humanities, social and behavioral sciences, the physical sciences, business and teacher education. Most institutions also offer students a traditional residential life experience. Each state university also has distinguishing undergraduate and graduate programs that I'm going to be telling you about now. In addition, the seven state universities play a really strong role in building local regional economies through applied research. We work with local businesses, industry, on research tied to innovation and product development, including commercialization, and which helps to create jobs. Now, let me start with Bemidji State University. Bemidji State University serves 6,500 students under the leadership of our newest president, Richard Hansen. Bemidji State offers an applied engineering program designed specifically for individuals who typically possess a 2-year technical degree and are interested in advancing their professional career. Metropolitan State University, with campuses in St. Paul and Minneapolis, serves over 9,600 students under President Sue Hammersmith. Metropolitan State hosts the Center for Women Entrepreneurs and Entrepreneurship Education, which offers cutting-edge programming to aspiring and existing business owners. The United States Peace Corps has selected Metropolitan State as a partner for returning U.S. Peace Corps volunteers. The campus I serve at Minnesota State University Mankato has over 17,000 students. The Princeton Review has ranked Minnesota State Mankato's business program as among the best in the country for the last five consecutive years. And Forbes magazine also recently ranked the university among the top quartile of America's best colleges. Minnesota State University Moorhead serves almost 9,000 students under the leadership of President Edna Szymanski. And working with Greater Fargo Moorhead's Economic Development Corporation, there's a concentration in vaccinology, which was developed to fill a growing need in the regional workforce. St. Cloud State University, under the leadership of President Earl Potter, serves around 21,000 students. Responding to industry needs, St. Cloud State University started two new graduate programs in medical device regulation and applied clinical research. And then finally, Southwest Minnesota State University in Marshall serves almost 8,000 students under the leadership of President David Danahar. With 2,400 food manufacturers in the state, the culinology program at Southwest provides graduates skilled in food product development. Winona State University, under the leadership of President Judith Romali, serves around 9,500 students. Winona State's Composite Materials Engineering Program is the only undergraduate engineering program of its kind in the United States. The university's National Child Protection Training Center is the premier trainer of child abuse investigators and prosecutors. I would now like to turn it back to Chair Thiss.
Thank you.
Chair Thiss.
Madam Chair, I'd like to explain the governance structure of the Board of Trustees. The Board has 15 members who are appointed by the Governor and confirmed by the Senate. Eight members represent the state's congressional districts, and four trustees serve at large. Those 12 trustees serve 6-year terms. In addition, three students, one from each of the system sectors, technical colleges, community colleges, and state universities, have full voting rights but only serve 2-year terms. The trustees hire a chancellor and institution presidents and have broad policy responsibilities for system strategic planning, academic programs, fiscal management, including a capital budget, personnel, admission requirements, tuition and fees, rules and regulation. And in addition, the board has broad oversight responsibilities in a host of other areas, including information technology, diversity, and outreach. Over the years, the board has adopted and modified a strategic plan that has provided invaluable guidance for the presidents of our colleges and universities. One-page version is in your packet. The focus has remained unchanged to enable the people of Minnesota to succeed by providing the most accessible, highest value education in the nation. The current plan has five strategic directions, which are to increase access, opportunity, and success, achieve high quality learning through academic excellence and accountability, enhance the global economic competitiveness of the state, its regions, and its people, innovate to meet current and future educational needs, and sustain financial viability during changing economic and market conditions. I'm happy to report that we have made progress, significant progress, in all five areas. Just a few examples. We have moved the needle when it comes to success rate of our underrepresented students. In 1 year alone, we have made a 2.2 percentage point increase in the success rate to nearly 73%. That's a substantial gain. We count and measure these students are those who have graduated, transferred, or stayed enrolled. That's our measure of success. This is hard and very important work. Improving the success rate is one of our top strategic goals. We believe this success is due in part to the additional resources that the legislature gave us several years ago. We are using the money for programs and services that have proven effective. About 128,000 students taking science, technology, engineering, and math, also known as STEM courses, is up from 107,000 only 5 years ago. The system has been so successful that, in fact, we have passed our 2011 goal for STEM enrollment by nearly 14,000 students. Our faculty members continue to be recognized for excellence in teaching and research. This year, Russ Colson, a geoscience professor from Minnesota State University Moorhead, became the first professor in the state's history to be named a U.S. Master's University Professor of the Year. In 2008, Eugenia Paulus, a chemistry professor at North Hennepin Community College, was the first professor in Minnesota to receive the U.S. Community College Professor of the Year. Minnesota State University Mankato has been named one of the nation's top producers of Fulbright scholars among master's degree institutions. Over the last 30 years, the university's faculty and staff members have received 37 Fulbright awards. Six community colleges in our system are ranked in the top 50 community colleges by Washington Monthly Magazine. This is the red magazine in your folder. Page 48 has the complete list. But the list is topped by our own St. Paul College. Also included, Itasca Community College, Alexandria Technical and Community College, Minnesota West Community and Technical College in Pipestone, Minnesota State Community and Technical College in Fergus Falls, and Vermilion Community College. Our colleges and universities continue to innovate. One example, Northland Community and Technical College is helping to create an entirely new industry by training technicians who can be certified in unmanned aircraft aviation maintenance. We also have four centers of excellence in manufacturing and engineering, healthcare, and information technology. Each is led by a state university and with its two-year college partners. The lead institutions are Bemidji State University, Winona State University, Mankato State University, Minnesota State University Mankato, Metropolitan State University. Altogether, these centers involve 21 system institutions. They work with related businesses and organizations to make sure we are teaching the skills and knowledge that workers need. These are just a few examples of the system successes. I'm going to turn it back to the Chancellor, who will wrap up this presentation. But before I do, I want to take a moment to acknowledge Chancellor McCormick, who will be completing 10 productive years as Chancellor of the system when his term ends this summer. Arrived, the system was only about 5 years old and still very much in development. Under the Chancellor's leadership, the system has matured in many ways. Our colleges and universities collaborate as they have never done before since the system existed. Each institution has strengthened its ties to its local region. Chancellor McCormick has probably visited many of you in your districts. Chancellor has created a culture of continuous improvement, accountability, and transparency in this large and diverse system. He has served the people of Minnesota well.
Thank you, Chair Fiss.
And I would like to add to the Chancellor my thanks. And he did have lunch with me in my district, so or maybe dinner, but several times, I believe. So your service has been wonderful, and we do appreciate it. And we are sad we are losing you, but you have, I guess, bigger and better things to do, and I believe it's grandchildren to hang out with too. So, but thank you again, and
thank
Chancellor,
you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Fishbach. We will, I know, have an opportunity to be back later in the session to talk about budget, maybe several sessions. We know how difficult it is. Recent years, I want you to know that we've had large enrollment growth, continuing shortfalls in state funding. So we look forward to helping you do your work as a group, and we want to continue to contribute so much to the strong economy and the revitalization of that economy here in Minnesota. I want you all to know that I'm very proud of our 32 colleges and universities. I believe they provide immeasurable benefit to the people of Minnesota. And this contributes greatly to the quality of life and to the economic vitality of the state. Minnesota, as I'm sure many of you know, has been known as a very productive state with a high quality of life. It is a reputation. As I circle my last lap, I believe it's so important for all of us to preserve this reputation. And we need it more than ever now as we are competitive in the global economy. And I look forward in the remaining months to serving the people of Minnesota in this position. Thank you. I think we're ready, Chair, for questions of any of us or comments.
Questions from the committee? Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I wanted to add my thanks and my appreciation for the 10 years that I worked with you. I'm just so proud of our Minsky system. And it was wonderful to hear you run through the high points of all the colleges and universities. I think that was it was quick, but it's a lot. And our students are very well served by the outstanding institutions that we have. And I know how hard the board has worked to make that possible, the presidents and the chancellor, and you have my deep appreciation. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Pappas.
Senator Sharon?
Yes. I can't remember who said this. Somewhere in the beginning, you talked about, I just want to make sure I understood this, that you accept all applicants into the Minsky system, into one of the colleges in the system, if they have a high school degree.
Or GED.
Or GED.
That's the two-year colleges.
So that means any student wanting to move to higher education is it true that they could go to any of those systems if they have that qualification, or might they be referred to another one? Whereas we were listening to the university the other day, and they talked about the ACT scores and the placement level of their students in high school graduation, which means that there must be a limit to the number of students that they're enrolling. So does this mean there's not, at the various campuses, there's not a limit to the students that are being admitted?
Well, we do have a culture of being open admissions since our early beginnings, Chair Fishbach and Senator Sharon. We do have this belief in open admissions. But we have enrollment pressures. And, for instance, we've never been able to accommodate all of the students in nursing, but they would be eligible to get in. But some of them have tighter enrollments than others, more pressure on the universities and the colleges here in the Twin Cities. So that is the open admissions, but we are under enrollment tensions and pressure. I wonder, Kevin, if you'd want to say a word about that.
I can, and Chair Fischbach and Senator Sharon, at the two-year colleges, it is open enrollment indeed, and these students are accepted to the college. Now, they are tested for placement in terms of where we put them in our courses to make sure they have an opportunity to be successful there, and that's where we run into the problem of academic readiness on occasion, where we look at the scores that they might have, and we start to look at the role of developmental types of programs for a number of those students. We are open. I can give you an example at our college. Our manufacturing programs have been full for the last 5 years. Our machine tool technology program, our welding program, our marine program, our diesel program, they're full today. And they're capped simply because we don't have enough room. We don't have enough workspace and equipment and the other types of things that we might be able to use. And that's not whining at all. We're happy to have those programs full and to have the students that that we do enroll. And could we serve more? Possibly.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that you work to be responsive to the needs of the employers. And I'm wondering if you could highlight for us a little bit about how you measure their needs, how you work with them to determine what sorts of skill sets that they are seeking of your graduates.
Chair Fischbach, Senator Roebling, we get heavily involved with those areas, and we do it in a number of ways. We do it through the work of our advisory committees, the manufacturing programs I spoke to you about. I walked into the mechatronics advisory committee this past fall, and there were 32 people sitting around the table from Germany, from around the United States, and from the central Minnesota region as well as the rest of Minnesota. It's our intent to find out from them the types of skills that they believe the next generation of employees need to be successful in the careers that they're starting on after they get out of our two-year college. The advisory committee is the biggest place for our academic credit programs. Many of our two-year colleges also have very, very strong customized training programs. And we work directly with them very much in a customer alignment where we have reps from our college who call on them often and bring back the types of needs that those folks need for retraining, realignment of the curriculum that we have that trains these folks, again, for next-generation types of jobs that are starting to emerge in those fields that drive our regional economies. Those are two main things that we do, Senator, to stay very, very current and most of the times ahead of where these employers really believe these students need to have skill sets.
Senator, and Chair Fischbach and Senator Roebling, three more things that we do. We have the capacity to assess the labor market, and we do a really good job of being able to determine shortages. We can tell through various data systems how many chemists we're going to need. Where we don't do well is in predicting the vast changes that are occurring. It's harder to do that, but we're trying to stay on top of data, which is supplied to presidents. In addition, just another word about these advisory committees. They're very important. They're part of our history, part of our culture, and there's not only advisory committees for the college, but for various programs, and we try to bring people from the business community in to keep them current, but also listen to what needs to be done. Also, last year, with the good support of Chair Olson and the board, all of our executives, all of our presidents made at least 10 visits to the business leaders of the state, and these were many of the small businesses in our community. We compiled that data about what they had to say about what we needed to do as we're staying current. We also tend to be involved with the Governor's Workforce Development Council, which I'm a member, on that data. We try to work closely with DEED in terms of that information to stay on top. But even though we try all of that, we're still not caught up with nursing. So it is not a perfect process.
I might add, Chair
President Davenport
and Senator Roebling, in addition to what you've already heard, I know the colleges and universities spend a lot of time interviewing our business community, whether in the private sector, public sector, whether it's healthcare, business, what have you. And we do that on a regular basis and have ongoing meetings in addition to the advisory committees, of which every college and university has many. And in that process, we usually find out what's working and what's not working. And we always ask, the very first question is, what do you need from graduates? What are you not getting? What's working or what isn't working? So we've learned to modify our programs based on that information. And we've gotten some very honest and good advice as to some of the skills, depending upon what the industry is that we're working with. So strategic business, corporate, educational, public partnerships are integral to what we do on the college campuses and the university campuses.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering, technology and knowledge changes so quickly, and I am wondering how the business community interacts with you on maybe even do you partner with them ever? Do they provide some of the technology that they have in your on your campuses so that the students can be working on what they actually would have when they get out into the job market? And with the instructors, do you have, where do you find them that are current enough so that they know exactly what's happening? Are a lot of them adjunct professors who come in from those fields, or where do they get their instruction? Yeah,
Chair Fischbach.
President Davenport.
Senator Roebling. It's a combination of all of that. That is, we use adjunct professors that are experienced, currently working in their field, in industry. And we also, depending on the area, make sure that the faculty have professional development opportunities to expand their horizons. I think the best thing, though, is the interaction between the faculty and the business community through internships. So we believe very strongly in cooperative education, and that brings the faculty in touch with the manufacturers or whatever the industry is. And then a good example, just if I can use Minnesota State at Mankato, we, on the IT, on the technology side, we realize that we're serving populations all over the state, even though most of our students are on campus in Mankato, that we need a better way to reach those students. And so in a partnership that we just recently signed off with Cisco, they're providing us, as a pilot site, telepresence units. Telepresence units are two or three steps up from the interactive video that has been around for so long, that allows us to meet students and employers where they are to provide them high-quality education. Those are a few examples of how we make that connection.
President Kopischke.
Chair Fischbach, Senator Roebling. The real heroes here are our faculty. Because if we don't have faculty leadership in these programs, the kinds of things that you've talked about don't happen. Let me give you a couple of examples. We have a Marina Small Engines program that has been driven by four people who are very passionate about what they do. During the last 6 years, they've developed an arrangement with Briggs & Stratton, where Briggs & Stratton has donated about 3,000 six-horse engines to the college. In turn, we've worked with our high schools around the state of Minnesota to provide them with a one-week training opportunity in the summer to come to the college, be updated with the curriculum and training on those engines, and then when they leave, they can take a pickup full of 20 engines back to their campus free of charge because of that donation that was arranged between our faculty and Briggs & Stratton. So the young people in our high schools have now an opportunity to work on the next generation technology. Next generation technology is a critical component in our technical fields. We have very few adjunct faculty in our technical programs. We need full-time people who are paying attention to the kinds of things that are happening there, who are able to work with business and industry to bring the next generation technology in everything from our computer science programs, our healthcare programs, our mechatronics program. We have a faculty member who spends a week and a half in Germany every summer working with the machine tool technology and packaging machine companies in Germany and Italy to bring that technology back to our region, because we have an industrial cluster of manufacturing technology companies in the community. We use that to help them train their employees, as well as integrating it into the curriculum that we offer in our two-year program. So again, the faculty are the key to making these things work. It's their interest, their passion, their desire to have a program that is second to none.
Senator Sharon.
This is a little bit different direction. I'm also concerned about what you described as you have open enrollment, but you also assess and target your students to track them where they best can be successful. And we're hearing a lot from the universities and in the public about the level of preparation in order to be able to take on beginning level courses at the university, and the consequence of that to be able to move through the system and get into the economy and participate quickly as possible, and the costs associated to the student for that and the costs to the university system for that. Can you talk about that a little bit and what the challenges are for us as a state and how we need to be responsive to that?
Chancellor McCormick?
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Sharon. I'm going to ask the Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs, Scott Olson, to come forward, because the board is very concerned with that. We've just had long discussions. About 30% of our students that come need some developmental work. It's a very, very serious concern, because we're going to need to get all of those numbers to be successful to be world-class competitive. It's a great question, and we'd like to share some of our thinking and some of the details. Scott?
Welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Fischbach. My name is Scott Olson. I'm the Interim Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs, and Chair Fischbach and Senator Sharon. Actually, at the universities, the number of students who are in remedial and developmental type courses is relatively small compared to at the colleges, and they tend to be in math. So if you looked at the universities, we've got maybe, I'm trying to remember the statistic, it's a single digit, maybe 7% of the students are taking some sort of remedial math course. They're at the universities not tending to take remedial reading, remedial English, remedial things like that. At the colleges, on the other hand, which have the open access mission, you see a much higher proportion of students taking not only math, but maybe some other courses. If I'm remembering the statistics right, and it would be our pleasure to provide all the detailed statistics to the committee if they would like it, but I think, I'm trying to draw this up from memory, but I think it's something like 90% of the students who are in remedial developmental courses are only taking one remedial or developmental course. Then the number that are taking two, three, four developmental courses to get ready is a fairly small number. But again, we can give you the precise data. We have that. We just did a presentation to our Board of Trustees on this about a month and a half ago. Hope that's helpful.
Thank you. Is it a follow-up on that? I do have another.
On this topic.
Follow-up, Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some of the latest research on remedial education has shown that it's often very discouraging to students if they have to take remedial courses because they're not getting credit, they're using up their financial aid, they're not progressing. And that some approaches that have been more successful from the research has been when it's at the same time or in concert with their course that they're taking, or even a summer bridge program that's very short and intensive, and then they're in the regular classes again. Are you following that research, and are you looking to influence how the individual colleges are delivering remedial education?
Chair Fischbach and Senator Pappas, there's two things that brings to mind. One is what we call stackable credentials in our Fast Track program and other programs we're working on are taking, infusing remedial type instruction with practical skill-based coursework that shows students that they are making progress while they're also catching up. So that's one approach that we're using at some of our institutions that are rolling out Fast Track. And again, we'd love to come back and give you more details about that. Another approach that we're just beginning to take a look at is making the remedial requirements modular. We need a little bit more, I'll use the word granular, approach to our diagnostics of what a student needs. But it may be that a student doesn't pass the Accuplacer placement test and gets placed in developmental math, but maybe all they were missing was one little unit on geometry, but that caused them not to do well, and so the whole thing goes down. So what we're looking at is some better diagnostics in the placement testing so that if a student only needs geometry or factoring in algebra or something, they could take a small unit on just that one topic, a modular unit, and then be caught up and off they go. And that's a way, again, of accelerating the process. So we are aware of that research. Folks on our staff are looking at that. We're trying to figure out the best way to deploy it on the campuses.
Chancellor McCormick.
Madam Chair, I just want to present Trustee Phil Krenke, who just joined us, and thank you for coming. But I want to go back to Senator Sharon's question. I think it's such an important one for the committee and for us. There's some research that I respect that suggests that in order for Minnesota to be world-class competitive with our workforce, we're going to need to have as many as 70% of our population with a bachelor's degree or more, a two-year degree, or a very solid accredited program at one of our two-year colleges. Now, if we're going to need 70%, and we're somewhere in the 40s now, we're going to have to find a way to help these students that are in the developmental program become successful and to have programs that are significant and meaningful. Because you can't get there without working on this problem and solving it. In addition to that, you can't just fix the pipeline because there won't be enough there either. We're going to have to work on the 2.5 million people that are employed in Minnesota and give them opportunities to come back, get what they need, get the courses that we need. So we have an enormous challenge in the next 5 or 10 years for Minnesota to be competitive by getting more people through. And this developmental solution, that will have to be part of that to create the workers we're going to need. I think it's a very important question. Thank you.
Vice Chancellor Olson has a follow-up also.
Well, Chair Fischbach, I do have one piece of data I just happened to have in my bag when I came in today that I could leave with you today, and it goes a little bit to what Senator Sharon and Senator Pappas are asking about. It compares what we call the success rate of students who took developmental classes against students who were not required to take developmental classes. Success rate measures sort of persistence. Did they stay? Did they graduate? Or did they successfully transfer to a different institution? All of those three things are measures of success. And at the university level, the success rate of after the first timer out for a student who did take developmental class is 79.5%. The success rate for someone who didn't take any is 83.6. So the difference is between 79.5 and 83.5. There's obviously a difference there, but I think the good news is it's actually not a huge difference. So students who were asked to take remedial and developmental didn't fall so hopelessly behind that you have a stark, huge number. And I'll leave these data with you so you can take a look at them. But again, we'd love to come back and tell you the whole story sometime.
Thank you very much. Senator Sharon, Senator Miller has been waiting, unless it's really specific
it's
to that point.
It's on this subject. Are you changing? Are you on the subject?
I'm changing the subject.
Okay, may I?
Senator Sharon.
I'm getting to the age where if I have a conversation, I forget my question. Part of my question was also, because of what you're saying, that we have to draw down people that may have started college and left for some reason and bring them back into the workplace and draw people out of the workplace and find ways to give them credit for what it is they've learned
yes.
in the workplace and then improve the students who in the past may not have even been in the university system. What can you tell me what we should be thinking about, the implications of that? Because that's new, maybe, obligation. Are factors or context in which you're working and using resources. So how do we think about that in relationship to not just supporting the systems and keeping the programs excellent and the faculty trained and excellent, but now adding this extra component to the process of higher education? What does it mean for us, and what do you want to tell us about that?
Madam Chair and
Chancellor McCormick.
Senator Chair, I want to be careful not to get into the budget discussion will come later. This is not cheap to help this group of students, and we talked about the numbers that we're doing, getting them college ready and work ready. And so our great plea is that with these huge increases that we're having in enrollment and the need for so many more graduates, we need to be as efficient as we can be and all of that, but we're going to need to have some investment in order to get all of that done. And so, obviously, my hope is, for a later discussion, is that as you face these tremendous cuts, that all of us are going to face, I hope you'll realize the tremendous responsibility in the job that we have. And this is not just an expense. It's an investment in our most precious resource, the people of Minnesota, and we're going to have to do it if we're going to stay world-class competitive.
Senator Sacksock.
Was thank you, Chairman Fischbach. Senator Miller, this is on the same subject, too. Okay.
Well, and committee members, I'm assuming that you're going to be asked to be called on.
So, and this is just a quick comment. Wouldn't it be nice if we took care of some of these remedial things before we got out of high school? And I don't know if you have to go as far back as to early childhood or what, but it could happen, you know.
Could happen. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chancellor McCormick and team, thank you very much for the presentation, and we appreciate all the work that that you guys do, especially the presidents at the at our local campuses. You guys do a great, tremendous job, so thank you for that. My question does just touch on the budget a little bit. Recently, you made some cuts at the central office, and I think that was a good proactive move. I'm wondering if you could explain those amounts a little bit and how those cuts were executed for us, please.
Senator Miller, or Madam Chair and Senator Miller, we can, and I'll ask the Chief Financial Officer to come, but just in round terms, we cut approximately 5 million and 41 people, and we're also giving up one of our floors at the World Trade Center, now Wells Fargo Center, and Laura kind of worked engineering that, Laura King, our Vice Chancellor for Finance, and she can give you some more detail.
Go ahead. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. Good afternoon, members. The Chancellor tasked us with looking forward to the 12-13 biennium and undertaking budget planning so that as he's transitioning out of the chancellorship, he had left the House in good order. And so we undertook a planning process that we finished last fall, and we predicated it on some assumptions about what the outcome of this biennial budget process would be. And that led us to a $4 million reduction, which was about not quite a 10% reduction in the Chancellor's office, the elimination of 40 positions. We accessed the early retirement program that the legislature passed last year, worked through the board on priorities and targeting areas of work that we had to protect and areas that we found we could no longer afford. And so that whole program was announced just after Labor Day. The HR program started at that point, and those personnel changes are continuing to roll out. Most of them have taken effect. A few of them have slipped into this first quarter. But we'll have the budget balanced and the personnel changes in place before the Chancellor's departure and before the end of the fiscal year.
Senator Miller.
I have a follow-up. Thank you. Chair Fischbach, my follow-up would be, from those cuts, was there any impact on the students?
Ms. King.
Madam Chair and Senator Miller, we tried to protect a couple of things when we were doing this. We tried to protect our legal and statutory obligations. We tried to protect the student-facing part of what we do, and we undertook it in a way that wouldn't result in work shifting to the campuses. So whole work went away. It wasn't just that we moved it from this column to this column. Student impacts, I don't think, are going to be very direct. We had some changes in some services that are offered in our office that are services that benefit the campuses. But the student-facing work we do is mostly in the information technology area, and we protected the investment in the Students First initiative, and that's moving very rapidly and very successfully and has a very high student benefit. So I would say not, that there would be, by design, we avoided student impacts.
Senator Miller.
One more follow-up. I think this goes along with it. Does the Minsku Central Office and do the local campuses have reserve funds, and how are those handled?
Yes, we do, and
certainly, Madam
Chancellor McCormick, Ms. King.
Certainly, Madam Chair and Senator Miller. Yes, the campuses do have reserves. We have a board policy that calls for reserves as a matter of presidential performance expectations. They are held in the name of each of the campuses, and they're available to the presidents. Under the board policy, they're designed to be available for things that were not planned. For example, several years ago, we had a roof blow off in, not Worthington, where'd the roof blow off? Wadena, the wrong W. And the campus used those reserves to fix their roof. We had a sudden change in federal funding from the Bureau of Indian Affairs at Fond du Lac Community College, and we used system reserves to help them because they lost a substantial amount of money very suddenly. So the reserves are held by each of the campuses. They're governed by board policy. By national standards, they're deemed to be at the low acceptable level, and they're important to us for our credit rating. When we sell bonds for the revenue fund, if we have reserves, we get a better credit rating, and that lowers the cost to the students.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does the central office also have a reserve fund?
Madam Chair and Senator Miller, the system at the board level also has a reserve that's in the $7 million range, which on a $1.9 billion annual organization operation is a pretty modest amount.
Thank you.
Senator Brown?
Madam Chair, I think just credibility and Chancellor. Integrity is the most important thing I have in my relationship with all of you. And Laura, I told him we were going to reach about $5 million, and you said $4 million. Do you want to try to bring that together? I don't think you counted the space, the savings we're going to have on the space. We gave them two numbers, and if I've been wrong, I want to correct it.
Madam Chair,
Ms. King.
Chancellor, you're not incorrect. You're just a year ahead of me. We did make a commitment to downsize our space, and that'll produce budget savings, which will show up in 12.
Thank you. Senator Brown.
Yes, Madam Chair. Chancellor McCormick, you've talked about the issues Minsky's facing in getting students college ready. What do you see some of the reasons they aren't? Is it because you are open enrollment? Is it our public schools need to do a better job? What would you see as some of the reasons that you're facing those challenges?
Senator
Chancellor McCormick.
Senator Brown. Happy to, and Madam Chair, I'm happy to talk about that for a little bit. I've never been one to point fingers and blame the public schools because we produce more than half the teachers. But we are working with the Bush Foundation and with our universities trying to improve the quality of our teachers. And we produce half of them in the state, and that is an important role that we can play in terms of helping the school districts improve. Also, we need to have partnerships with schools, and we have some of them. And I could talk generally, but I want Kevin Kapishki to just tell you what we're doing, just a brief report on what we're doing in rural Minnesota to try to address that problem. And I think that that will be some of the work that we're trying to do to help students be ready. And also, how do we motivate students? How do we make them really want to get it? That's a hard problem. I don't have all the answers, but I want to tell you about rural Minnesota, Madam Chair, for just a minute.
Chair Fischbach.
Senator Brown. One of the things that's happening in rural Minnesota is that there are significant demographic changes, and those of you who live out there where I live understand that. And we have high schools that are having a very difficult problem putting a faculty profile together that can teach the types of courses that these young people need as they move through their high school opportunities and into colleges and universities. We're finding some very, very interesting and very, very innovative partnerships beginning to emerge around the state. In southeastern Minnesota, southwestern Minnesota, the Northeast Higher Ed District has a fantastic partnership with, I think, 17 or 18 high schools. In Alexandria, we're working with an online college in the high school initiative that's connected us with about 45 high schools around the state who are accessing their coursework from us. What we're finding is that we are here in need of a new design. That's all I can say. We need to rethink how we back up into K-12 and get these young people ready for whatever is going to come. We've done some of that. We're moving some pilots ahead, as I mentioned, in and around the state. Much of it, though, focuses on that student who is having more difficulties. As we move from that 40% to 70% of readiness, which students do you think the colleges are going to have to serve? The upper third or the bottom two-thirds? It's the bottom two-thirds, and many times the bottom third. And many times they have some academic challenges that we simply need to address, because it's not a choice to not get them ready for the workplace. It's not a choice. They simply have to be made ready for the workplace. So that's my sense then, as we start to back up the system a bit and ask ourselves, and we're doing that in rural Minnesota, how can we work together better with our rural school districts from our rural regional center colleges to make this learning environment much more inclusive and much more integrated? And that's a good deal for everybody. It's a better investment for the state of Minnesota because we can move to some efficiencies. It's a great opportunity and investment for parents and students because they can get ready quicker and access high school courses at the same time as they access college-level courses for those who are academically ready to do that. And they can move into our institutions of higher education at an advanced level, moving along possibly a career path and possibly not. We're not tracking people. We're getting them ready for the academic challenges that they simply must face in this environment of a global society that's in front of that generation coming after us.
Senator Brown.
Madam Chair, so is it fair for me to surmise by what you just said that our rural school districts are facing challenges that Minneapolis and St. Paul districts are not facing?
Madam Chair, President Senator Brown, the challenges are different, but they are certainly as difficult in the Twin Cities as they are in rural Minnesota. We don't speak 27 languages in our college. We serve less underrepresented students, certainly, than the metropolitan areas do. So, again, the major component here is understanding the demographic, because the demographic then drives the enrollment. And there's not a little box of a one-size-fits-all solution here. And I think we found that the leadership of our metropolitan campuses, the faculty, staff, and administration, working to ready those students is as important as what's happening in rural Minnesota. But the problems in some places are different. In some places are the same. If you go to Worthington, you go to St. James. I'm a board member of the Minnesota Minority Education Partnership at a board meeting the other day, and happened to be a friend of mine who's a faculty member at St. James, talking about the challenges that they have in St. James, Minnesota. Interesting kinds of things happening there. But it's not a choice to not get those students ready. They simply have to be ready because the economic vitality of this state is at risk if they are not ready.
Senator Brown and Madam Chair, I also think we can't do it alone. We need families and parents and communities. We need business people out in all of these communities to take a student under their wing, show them what an engineer is. We're going to have to work on this as the family, the whole society, the community. It's all of that. And we have a number of corporations in the state that get recognized at the Business Partnership each year for having programs where many of their employees are working with individual students and all of that. It's going to take all of that. It just can't be the schools alone, I don't think. It's going to have to be a broader community commitment to helping people be ready and to get through.
Senator Sharon.
This is along the same lines. It's one of the things, I think there are multiple factors that are influencing our successes or failures of students to be ready for higher education. One that I hear about is alignment of the expectations for high school degree or diploma or alignment of the criteria for graduation with the expectations or competencies necessary to begin university or college level work. Can you talk about what is being done with these collaborations, K-12 and higher ed, to not only prepare teachers to teach what needs to be taught, but making certain that what's being learned is progressively moving someone towards the higher degree?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I think Richard has given me the signal he has some thoughts on that.
Madam Chair,
President
Senator
Davenport.
Sharon. I'll give a few examples, but first of all, I want to say that the real secret here is working closely with the school districts in the region of the colleges and or universities. And I can speak about the region in south central Minnesota where we have very, very close relationships and partnerships with District 77 and also related districts in the region. We have come together in advisory fashion to try to understand why some students are successful and others are not successful. Some are ready to go right away and others are not. So we pilot a lot of experiments and a lot of programs. And one in particular that we're working on right now, which has been approved by the Board of Trustees and Chancellor McCormick, is a pilot project for a three-year baccalaureate degree working with the school district. And in this particular case, we are looking for high achievers to enter that program so that they can move through their four-year degree more quickly. And it does build on PSEO and advanced placement, but we're going beyond that. Now, that is relatively new as a way to approach the problem and create an alignment. With the students that are not as advanced, that presents a different challenge. And there we are interested in working with the school, in the schools, not to tell them how to do it, but to try to learn best practices. As the Leeds University and the Bush Foundation Reform Education Project, where Bush Foundation has put in over $40 million, we're working with the school system to try to understand how can we do a better job of educating and training teachers. And that means these teachers have to know how to work with students that are at that lower end as well as the upper end in terms of academic success. So the closeness working with the school districts is how we try to get some of the answers that are necessary to bring these two together, because there is a gap right now, and we understand the value and importance of closing that gap in terms of expectations, in terms of preparation, and working together truly as partners. You know, we're fortunate in Mankato to have a superintendent of schools that is open to just about anything that will help us to resolve the problem, working in early childhood, of course. And we have corporate leaders who have made this a priority. So Taylor Corporation, I can speak from South Central, has adopted this as their major focus, early childhood. What can we do? So we have a community advisory groups supported by the Taylor Corporation, who's brought in many other corporate groups to help provide the funding and support for the initiative. So there is no one answer, but this is one way in which we're trying to create a better sense of expectation.
And Madam Chair, there's going to be a lot of hard decisions about where limited funds go in terms of investment. But what I want to say, it is my belief, and I think the research backs me up, we get a great return on the investment we have in early childhood. And the evidence is clear. If a child is not reading by the third grade, it becomes very difficult and very challenging to have that student catch up with all of the things that we're doing. So I think we've got to do that well. And I'd like to suggest that as the time comes, we invest more in early childhood. I think our system could be one of the preparers of those talented individuals that are going to have to work in the early childhood area.
Well, I have a question now. I was wondering, is there someone here who would talk a little bit more about the online courses? I'm just curious about those. I've always just kind of wondered how you're offering, what kind of classes you're offering, and my understanding is you have some kind of central, not a depository, but central group that deals with it and goes out to all of the campuses. But I'm wondering, is it really effective? And maybe just give me some background on that. And
Madam Chair, before
catch off guard,
before Scott tells you about that, I like little stories. I was up on the Superior campus, two-year campus, about 2 years ago, and I'm walking up to some function, and an instructor about my age said, you're Jim McCormick. I said, yes. He said, I was completely opposed to this online education, but I did start to work on it. He said, the reason I was opposed to it, I thought maybe the students wouldn't have as significant a relationship with me. But he said, what I have to tell you is that as soon as I got into this, I realized that if I had 30 students, I was dealing with the 10 that sat closest to me. And what I'm now realizing
And this is an older person who's changed. What I'm now realizing is that with online, I'm talking to all 30. I'm talking to the ones that are shy, sitting in the back. And he said, I just wanted you to know that I was against it 100%. I have been converted, and I think that I'm making a great contribution. So that's just one instructor, one little story. So.
Thank you very much. And Vice Chancellor Olson.
Chair Fischbach, the repository you were asking about is called Minnesota Online, and it would include online courses and online programs that are offered throughout our system. It's growing rapidly in popularity, and we are quickly approaching a goal that Governor Pawlenty set for us maybe 4 years ago or so in terms of the number of our courses that were offered online. I've taught online myself. And can tell you that it's different than teaching face-to-face, but there's some wonderful things about it. So there are trade-offs, and I think there are certain subjects that are not at all well taught online, but there are other subjects where teaching them online might be actually the best way to do it. I guess what I would say is it approximates a tutorial in many ways. So it time shifts the interaction you're having with a student. But some students who might be very shy about putting their hand up and saying something in class might, in a chat room or might in an email, say something to their fellow students that's actually quite profound. And because they had the time to collect their thoughts and think about what they wanted to say, they can say some very interesting things. So the answer is it really depends. And it also depends on the learner. Some students learn very well in that environment. Other students really struggle to learn in that environment.
Thank you.
We just today got a report on student satisfaction with our online learning tool, and that's been increasing. And their satisfaction with the courses that are offered and the programs that are offered. And again, if the committee would like to take a look at some of those results, I'd love to come back and share them with you.
One thing we learned, Madam Chair, when we first started we thought it would just be the instructor and the student. But we learned that those students need student services too, need help. One of the things that has kind of happened with our consolidation and our looking for efficiencies is that at a little place out in Minnesota West at one of our smaller campuses, we can't offer everything. But the student's able to go to that location, and they probably can get the major wind energy or whatever, but the course they need, they might need to get online. And so there's someone there to help them sort of get that figured out about how to use the system. And then there are other students that have distance problems that are able to use it, not have to travel in the very difficult winter. It's an individual thing, though. And we have not forced instructors and professors to do it. They've picked it up as they care to. The other thing we really need to say, one of the great growth is in hybrid programs, where they're taking both classes and doing some things online. That seems to be growing. So it's developing. I think we would say, Scott, you think we have the research that a student taking that course is as well prepared as the one that took the traditional course? Do we have some evidence that would suggest that's the case?
Chair Fischbach and Chancellor McCormick, yes, I think you could say that. And it's actually the rare course now that doesn't have some sort of online component to it. At a minimum, you know, the syllabus online. But this hybrid course type that the Chancellor's referring to is a growing phenomenon, and that entails a mix of things you're doing online, interactions you're having online, and then some face-to-face interactions. That is the future.
And to anyone who wants to answer, I won't pick on anybody. But, you know, I know that the hybrids tend to be, or maybe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the labs where you're doing some homework online and then going in and doing labs in person with the professor there. And Vice Chancellor, you mentioned that there was some that worked better than others, some kinds of courses that worked better than others. Are you using it across the board at this point, or are you or do you see where it is working? You have a lot of those hybrid lab ones, and maybe none in the philosophy area. Or so, do you see a trend?
Chair Fischbach, there are certain. I would say in most fields there are some courses that are online, but it's easy to imagine how we were talking earlier about Normandale being accredited in theater. It's hard to imagine an acting class that's geared toward theatrical presentation that could easily be done online. Yeah. Now, I could be persuaded I'm wrong about that, but that would be an example of a way that would be difficult to do it. But there's other fields, philosophy, where, in fact, that was sort of how that tutorial was how Socrates taught. So that might be very appropriate for philosophy. And I think you'd see in different disciplines experiments going on with faculty trying different things and seeing where it works and where it doesn't. With labs, there are some things that you can do as preliminary labs in chemistry and physics in particular that are much lower cost, where students can experiment with things, and unlike my mom when she was at the U of M, not blow up the chemistry lab by accident, because they can try different things online, and then as they advance into more advanced level courses, actually get into what we call the wet lab and really deal with real materials. So it does pose that kind of cost-saving opportunity too.
And Vice Chancellor, then when you're talking about cost savings, my understanding is the online courses generally are a little more expensive. And maybe you could just, because
Chair Fischbach,
you brought up the cost savings.
Sure,
so.
Chair Fischbach, it depends. If you're talking about instructional cost, it's about a wash. And in terms of development costs, putting a course online, the initial cost of putting it up online, the time that it takes to develop all those materials and so on, that is a bit pricey. But once it's online, some aspects of it relative to the other courses could be less expensive. But I wasn't making the claim that all online courses are cheaper than all face-to-face courses. That would not be true at this point.
Okay. And I wasn't saying you did. I was just, you opened it up. So I thought I'd ask you. Made me click. But are there any other questions from the committee? Well, I thank you very much. We are actually 10 minutes early getting out of here. So thank you so much. And
thank
really
you.
Appreciate you taking the time to come now.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are adjourned.